The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on 101.3 KPCG, online we're at kpcg.fm, and have a live link at thetrumpet.com. I'm Dwight Falk, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury. As many of you know, he is on a series of personal appearance campaigns, which wraps up this evening, and so he should be back in a day or so. And a lot of you do subscribe to the Daily Trumpet Brief, and so you probably saw some of these numbers from yesterday. If you don't subscribe to the Trumpet Brief, I'd recommend you do that. It's free, and it's at thetrumpet.com, and it gets sent to your email inbox most every day, and it's got some good news updates, including yesterday's update about the personal appearance campaign. It said there were 116 who attended in Phoenix, Arizona. This was on Sunday. Attendees came from New Mexico and Arizona, and there were 50 non-members who attended, giving a 39% attendance rate. Of those, 17 signed up for a future Bible study. So that's excellent news there. And then I did get a sneak peek on the numbers from last evening in Los Angeles. About 115 attended, and 42 of those were non-members. So one more campaign this evening. And hopefully it'll be a really good turnout there as well. So there'll be, I'm sure, more information coming out about those on future Trumpet Briefs. And again, it's something you can definitely be praying about. And a lot of our listeners that are in those areas have a chance to attend and to even help out in some fashion or go just to attend it. So pretty exciting news there. Really good show today, I think. Lots of really good information to get into. A few headlines here to start with. And then in the second half of the program, I want to give some history on a really interesting fellow who's dead now, but he lived during World War II. His name is Richard Sonnenfeld. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he was very instrumental in the Nuremberg trials. And there's some really good life lessons from him, and the overall focus in that section of the program is going to be on how he had a lot of trials in his life. He faced a lot of difficulties, but he took them all with a certain excitement. He looked at it as an adventure. He had a great sense of adventure. And because of that, he had a lot of success. He had a lot of success in life, and there's a lot of lessons we can learn from that. So it's fascinating history from the World War II time period, but there's also some lessons we can get from it as well, which is why I want to cover that later today. A few headlines to start with today. This comes in from our news bureau. They send a daily news update to us. And just touch on this briefly. It was on the news on the top of the hour. You can't escape this. It says, our news bureau writes, remember President Trump's tweets that Ilhan Omar should go home if she hates the U.S. so much. Of course, that's been in the news here. Pretty much that's what actually a lot of people probably do think, but not the people you're going to hear talking in the media platforms. Hollywood's come out, the Democratic politicians, British and Canadian leaders have come out. They're all criticizing President Trump. And so don't want to get into the weeds of that story too much because it is pretty volatile. But what I do think is interesting is that the Democratic politicians, they basically make their living attacking President Trump every single day in every way possible, don't they? I mean, they are constantly nettling him, constantly accusing him, constantly attacking him. And then he comes back and says something to them, which they don't like, of course. And now it's an outrage. Now it's an outrage. And it reminds me of, and you've probably experienced this yourself at some point in life, whether it's been from a sibling or a peer at school. Maybe you've done it yourself, but where you have two people. Young kids especially, and the one just keeps poking the other in the arm, just repeatedly poking them over and over and over again. And finally, the other person turns around and maybe slaps their hand or does something. And the instigator then starts crying and yelling and tells the parent or the teacher, you know, they're hitting me. Tell them to stop hitting me. Well, one's been instigating the whole time. And that's what's really happening here, I think, on a very simplistic level, if you want to look at it that way. Constant instigation, constant attacks, constant nettling. And then the response is something they don't care for, and they're outraged by it. So just constantly bickering there in the politics in the United States. So probably going to see a lot more of that as we get closer to the elections. And it can get pretty disgusting to watch, but that's some of what's going on there. And you really can't avoid it today. It's a top headline almost everywhere. Probably more importantly, over the weekend, there was a situation with Angela Merkel over there in Paris. This is from Bloomberg. It says Merkel turns Paris visit into a show of fitness after tremors. You've heard on the Trump Daily Radio Show over the last few weeks a little bit about Angela Merkel having these tremors where she was standing in public ceremonies and she started to shake and she couldn't stop. And so, of course, people look at that. I think she's about 65 or so. And they look at that and they think, boy, her health is having an issue. So she was trying to show that she is, in fact, strong. It says German Chancellor Angela Merkel demonstrated physical fitness during Bastille Day celebrations in Paris, walking about a half mile without incident after suffering three bouts of trembling in public since June. With temperatures around 68 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 degrees Celsius, Merkel walked 10 minutes to the German embassy after attending a two-hour military parade on France's national holiday, during which she both sat and stood. At the embassy, she stood while making brief comments to reporters, thanking President Emmanuel Macron for inviting her and several other European leaders to Sunday's event. She turned 65 on Wednesday, so it's coming up here in a day or so. Tomorrow, actually. So she's facing questions, they say, about whether health concerns will prevent her from completing her fourth term, which ends in 2021. Last week, she said she's aware of the responsibilities of her office and will act on questions regarding my health. So she tried to demonstrate that she has a certain level of fitness, and nothing there is too outstanding, I guess, standing and walking. But if you've had a problem doing that, then I guess maybe that bodes well. It says about 59% of Germans view Merkel's health as ultimately a private matter, while 34% say she should come clean, according to a poll published Sunday. The internet-based CiviPoll has a margin of error of plus or minus 2.7 percentage points. So around 59%, give or take, of Germans think, well, it's her personal business, which is true. But obviously, if she doesn't have the health to continue in the office, something else would have to happen there. After the parade, Merkel walked with Macron to salute several war veterans. The chancellor has been in power since 2005. It's a long time to stay in power. She's Europe's longest-serving leader, so she's been there for quite a while. Our news bureau sent this about Bastille Day, where she was attending. It says Bastille Day focuses on 10-nation military union. So if you know much about Bible prophecy, that number will jump out to you as something that's important. It says, as usual, France had a big military parade on Bastille Day, except this time it was European military union on display. The 10 nations in Europe's European Intervention Initiative and paraded down the Champs-Élysées there. The parade involved 4,000 military personnel, 69 military airplanes, 39 helicopters. The 10 nations in the union there that were at this will not be, it says, the final 10 nations of that prophesied beast. They don't quite align with that, but there are 10 nations there right now. Those nations were Belgium, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, France, Germany, Netherlands, Portugal, Spain, and the UK. So as you, if you know much about that 10-nation union, the UK will not be included in that, and there's an eastern leg there that is missing. So there's a lot more information you can study into there on thetrumpet.com to get into those specifics if you want to remind yourself or if you haven't looked at it before. But still, they are showing off some of their military. The one thing that was kind of eye-catching, I guess, maybe you saw they had a flying soldier. He was on sort of like a hovercraft, and I guess the guy that was doing it is pretty good on those hoverboards, so it's not like anybody could just jump on it and start flying around, but it looked like something out of a, I don't know, some sort of futuristic movie. So that was an interesting, eye-catching situation there, but overall, They do have some military that they're trying to develop in that region, although the configuration of nations will be changing some. Here's another headline. This is kind of interesting. It relates to some history that's coming up here about Apollo 11. This is from Fox News. It says, Apollo 11, Queen's historic message to the astronauts on show to mark the 50th anniversary. 50 years ago this week, on the eve of the historic Apollo 11 launch, world leaders were invited by NASA to send messages to the moon. The Queen's message was sent on a tiny disc carried by astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, and it reportedly read, and this is from the Queen, she said, "On behalf of the British people, I salute the skills and courage which have brought man to the moon. May this endeavor increase the knowledge and well-being of mankind." And so the archives reportedly include an apology from then UK Ambassador to the United States, John Freeman, for missing the historic Apollo 11 launch. That's a bad thing to miss. The Guardian reports that he admitted his absence was a mistake, but explained that having witnessed the launch of Apollo 10 at Cape Kennedy just 2 months previously, a further visit so soon afterwards would have been a pure pleasure jaunt, he said. So he missed the historic launch of Apollo 11. In addition, four tiny pieces of moon dust, which were gifted to Great Britain by President Richard Nixon, can also be seen at the exhibit. So some really interesting history there. I believe there's a write-up at thetrumpet.com about some of that history, and I think there will be a radio program. I think The Sun Also Rises radio program will have some information about that Apollo 11 launch as well. So the 50th anniversary, it's a pretty big deal, and some places are having these exhibits where you can see things from that historic launch. Well, we have a, as many of you know, we have a Philadelphia youth camp that's going on here on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College, where we are broadcasting to you from. And so I think it's about 132 campers that are making a lot of joyful noise as they play and participate in a wide variety of activities. There's really a lot for them to do. And I've been able to help out this year a little bit. Occasionally I help with the camps. Not every year, but this year I am helping out with one of the sports programs. And so it's good. It increases my physical fitness, that's for sure. It gets me up and going more than I normally do, which is great. But I was thinking about the sports and all the different programs that the young people have a chance to be part of. And this next news article caught my attention in relation to that. What's happening with a lot of young people today in the United States is that, well, there's of course, there's a sort of extremes. There are those that just don't do a whole lot. You know, they're more focused on maybe being on their phones or something, and they're not as involved in physical activity. But then there are, of course, as you know, major sports programs for young people where that really becomes sort of their whole focus in life. All they want to do is play usually one particular sport. They find something that they're good at and they have a bit of a knack for, and they go after it. And that's about all they do. And so there are getting to be some problems with that and causing some problems for some young people. So this is a write-up from ESPN talking about that. And it's, I think it's pretty interesting, especially if you are a parent, you have a young person that's coming up and you're trying to help them grow and develop. There's something to take note of here, I think. It says, these kids are ticking time bombs, talking about these young people that are hyper-focused on one sport in particular to the exclusion of just about everything else. And it starts out by talking about a NBA player. He still plays in the NBA. That's the National Basketball Association. He's a professional basketball player. And it says, a few years ago, Julius Randle, then a rookie for the Los Angeles Lakers, had his leg break during a game. And so there was no contact with any other player. His leg simply broke. And, of course, it's a horrific incident anytime a leg breaks, especially in a sporting contest like that in front of people. And they did an X-ray, and they found that Randle had suffered a what they call a stress reaction. It's a precursor to a stress fracture, but without the break. Repetitive impacts to that bone had led its structure to break down, and a team spokesman later said that the stress reaction is likely what contributed to the break. So this continual repetitive motion on the leg over years and years and years caused that bone to break down somewhat. And he didn't know it until it broke on him completely. Dr. Nehru Jayanthi is the director of sports medicine research and education at Emory Healthcare in Atlanta. And he's one of the leading researchers on youth sports. He says, I have many kids who are going to go play in college next year. And this whole year has just been about trying to get healthy so they can step on that doorstep as a freshman and actually have a chance to participate. He says kids are broken by the time they get to college. So there are these young people that are playing whatever the sport may be. In this case, they're focusing on basketball. And they're playing it so much when they're young and not doing anything else, you know, in terms of really physical movements. They're always doing those same repetitive movements of that sport that by the time they get to college, their bodies have already broken down, if you can imagine that. I mean, college is kind of the, well, I don't know if it's a prime of your life, but it's certainly one of those time periods that should be pretty good. There should be a lot of health there. And so these kids are already broken by that time period. Now, again, it's not to say that they shouldn't be playing sports. Sports are great. It's just that they're doing that one particular sport that they gravitate towards so much to the exclusion of everything else that their bodies simply break down because of the repetitive motion. And they give the example in this article of Michael Jordan. Now, if you know anything about basketball, you know Michael Jordan, right? Even if you don't know about basketball, you probably know Michael Jordan. He is a celebrity because of how good he played the game, how well he played it. And he missed very few games. His rookie year, he did break his leg, but I think that was more of, I can't remember all the details there. But after that, he very rarely missed any games. And he played for 13 seasons in Chicago. He had a few years after that somewhere else. But those 13 seasons, he rarely missed a game. But notice this. This is what's really interesting. It says, when the season ended, Michael left and played golf and didn't pick up a basketball again until probably a little bit before training camp in September, says Wally Blase, a Bulls athletic trainer from 1993 to 2000. It says he might have played a pickup ball game with some friends, but he wasn't working 8 hours a day at some gym with some shooting coach. They say, and in contrast to the myth that has grown around him, Jordan didn't treat every practice as if it were game seven. You know, he didn't put the utmost value on every single practice. It says there were days when he would show up, put ice on his knees, and then he'd go play golf. Now, he was at a professional level to where he could take a day or two off. It's not to say that you should take practices lightly or something like that, but he was at such a high level and they did it so often that some days he just needed to rest. And so they did. And they say Jordan wasn't unique in this regard. Former Lakers head athletic trainer Gary Vitti spent 32 years with the team. He says the Showtime Lakers, that was the Laker team from the 80s, and they called them Showtime because they were very exciting and people liked to watch them play, and they had this exciting brand of basketball. It says they hardly played any basketball when the season ended. They just took a break. You know, they're playing it for years, and they're playing it for months at a time at a high level. So when the summer came, and it was the off season, they took it off. They took a break. They did something else. They let their bodies rest and recuperate. It says, as soon as the season was over, everybody would take at least 2 weeks off, 2 to 3 weeks, give their bodies a rest, let them recover, and then slowly they would do some either jogging or biking, some strength training. They would take time to let their bodies recuperate and rest. You know, there is this drive that some people have, and it's in the culture of some of these sports where, you know, the idea of, hey, if you're not practicing right now, somebody else is, and they're going to be better than you, and that sort of mentality that you always have to be practicing. Practicing is tremendous. It's a great thing, and to get good at anything, a person has to practice. But there's a balance to activities. You know, years back, as it's pointing out here, even these professional athletes, they would spend time doing a variety of things. Yes, they would play their sport and focus on it, but then they would take a break and they would let their bodies heal. They would let their bodies recuperate and they become rejuvenated, and then they get back into it when the time came. And so there is this growing, I don't know what you'd call it. It's just a movement that young kids are focusing in so early on one particular, in this case, athletic activity, and not doing a wide range of sports, and their bodies are breaking down. And as it pointed out, by the time some of these kids get to college, they're physically already broken. Legs have problems, knees, hips, etc., whatever it might be, because they're just so focused in on that one activity. It says, this write-up from ESPN says, as the Orlando Magic strength and conditioning coach from 2006 to 2012, Joe Rogowski saw young players struggle with simple movement patterns. So to help, he'd have players participate in different sports during the summers. They would do swimming. They would play beach volleyball. Now, again, these are professional basketball players he's dealing with. And he says, hey, you know what? You should go swimming a little bit. Maybe try to play a little beach volleyball. Right? The movements are a little bit different. The sport's a little bit different. The muscles that are worked are a little bit different. And so it balances the body out. He said it broke up the monotony, but also cross-trained them for years after hyper-focus on basketball. Their bodies needed to do something different. It's not that they needed to just be lazy and not do anything, but they needed to take a break from the repetitive motions, so they did something different. That's the way it used to be, right? I think it did when I was growing up, and I think probably for many listening, you'd play a variety of things. You know, during the basketball season, you might play basketball. Then when baseball came around, you'd play baseball. Then when, you know, there was nothing going on, you'd ride your bike or go swimming or do something different. The variety of activities kept the body balanced. And of course, if you want to get really good at one particular thing, then, yeah, you have to put a little more time into it, of course. And we're talking about physical endeavors here. But there is a balance to it. There is a balance to the way that we would put effort into something. The sports scientist's conclusion is this. Those who are highly specialized in one sport at the exclusion of other sports, so they're just doing one thing, nothing else, and they say, and played it year-round, were at a significantly higher risk for serious overuse injuries, such as bone and cartilage injuries and ligament injuries. How much higher of a risk? 125%. 125% greater risk for injury for some of these young people. And again, it's because of these, I guess, three factors. Highly specialized in one sport, not playing any other sports, and playing that particular sport year-round and not taking a break from it. Young people that were doing that at about 125% greater risk of what they call overuse injuries, such as bone and cartilage injuries and ligament injuries. So something to think about there. Now, again, that's in no way to say don't be involved in sports. Those things are great. Matter of fact, a lot of times people get injuries these days because of underuse, because they don't use them, right? So, and there's been so many reports about the dangers of just sitting all day and how that's not good for the cardiovascular system and other things. So we were created to move, but we were created to have a variety of movements, to move in different ways, and to make sure that we are balancing our bodies out. Cross-training, as they call it, I guess that would be the term that is often used, but that's what it is. It's doing different activities, different motions, and making sure that the body has a chance to develop different strength and different coordination and to balance out. And of course, you read something like this and you think about these studies that humans get very involved in and think a lot on, and then it goes back to some simple biblical truth. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 25, it says, and every man that strives for the mastery is temperate in all things. And here Paul is talking about spiritual growth, running a spiritual race, but he's relating it to physically running. And we can relate to that. Every man that strives for the mastery is temperate in all things. And temperate means showing moderation or self-restraint, right? I mean, so if you want to be good at something, of course you're going to work at it, but you're also going to be temperate. You know, you're not going to overdo it. You're going to do it enough to develop the skill, but then you're going to take a break, and then you're going to do something else. You're going to have moderation. right? Not too much of one thing. Running's good, but if you run all the time and you never do anything else and you overrun, well, eventually you're going to have a problem, right? And that's not to say running's not good. It is. But if you overdo it, well, then it's a problem. So it's talking about being temperate, being moderate, enjoying a wide variety of activities. And that's something that we really do focus on here at the Philadelphia Youth Camp. If you look at the schedule of that, those activities, very varied activities. And it's designed, the program's designed to develop the whole person, physically, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, the whole man, the whole person. There's different activities. The young people go canoeing. Then they do archery. Then they play basketball. Then some of them will play volleyball. Some will play flag football. They'll play softball. Then they have a speech class, and they learn how to speak and communicate. They have Bible studies. A wide variety of activities. There's musical endeavors. A wide range of activities used to develop the whole person. And so it's a tremendous program. Of course, it's just a beginning for young people here. It's something that gives them a chance to get a taste for that kind of lifestyle, that life of doing a lot of great activities, different activities. And then when they go home, hopefully they continue in it. And they'll find one or two things that they like more than something else. And maybe they'll put a little more effort into it, but not get so focused in on just one thing that either there's overuse injuries, or maybe if it's not a physical activity, you know, they don't, they focus so much on something where they wouldn't have enough physical activity. Again, we're reminded in God's word to be temperate, to be moderate, to do a lot, to have a variety of things. And that provides good physical health and really helps develop the whole person. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to get into a little history here about a really interesting man. His name's Richard Sonnenfeld, and he had a real spirit of adventure, and I think it will help spark your spirit of adventure, too. We'll talk about that right after this here on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online we're at kpcg.fm, and we have a live link at thetrumpet.com. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
One may blind his eyes to existing facts and trends and say the world cannot get any worse than it already is. Or, if we just ignore the conditions and don't worry, perhaps they'll go away. But these conditions and trends won't just go away. Not unless they are caused to go away. The scriptures of the Holy Bible, the inspired revelation of the Supreme God, have foretold today's world conditions and trends, and give us the advance news of coming peace on earth, of universal prosperity, of happiness and joy, of veritable utopia. This is the good news of the world tomorrow, and it is absolutely sure. This coming world is vividly described in our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. Bible prophecy explains in detail how God will intervene to save mankind from destroying himself. Jesus Christ will return to earth, putting an end to the rule of man and restore God's government on earth. To learn much more about this prophesied utopia, please visit thetrumpet.com.
Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on 101.3 KPCG. And online, we're at kpcg.fm. And we have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. I'm Dwight Falk, filling in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury, who is conducting a series of personal appearance campaigns, and he should be back here in a day or so, depending on his travels. Well, in the first half, we were talking a little bit about not overdoing it on one physical activity, as some young people have been doing. We have some comments online that have come in about that, and a few people were remembering Bo Jackson. And I remember Bo Jackson when I grew up. He was kind of the pioneer of the cross-fitting idea, I guess. You remember the advertising campaigns, Bo Knows, and that he would play all these sports, of course, because he was a professional football and baseball player, and so they'd have him doing just about everything. It was kind of a funny ad campaign because he, no matter what the sport was, he was the pro at it. You know, they'd pick random, sort of obscure sports and made a pretty good advertising campaign out of that. Unfortunately, he got hurt playing football, but he was really quite a gifted athlete at the time. Well, I wanted to spend some time talking about a man who has since died, but had a really interesting life, and really highlight his courage and his appetite for adventure. We all do come across some trials in our lives, and a lot of times the perspective that we take can make a big difference. This man's name was Richard Sonnenfeld, and he, I don't know if you've heard of him before. I had not heard of him until I read this book that he wrote. But he was an interrogator at the Nuremberg trials after World War II. And he died on October 12, 2009, a few years ago. He was 86 years of age. And the New York Times had a little write-up about him. And they said, the many lives of the man who translated at the Nazi war trials. He was a German-born Jew who fled his native country at age 15. So he was a young man when his life got turned upside down. Mr. Sonnenfeld found himself face-to-face with almost two dozen Nazi oppressors only 7 years later in 1945. So his life really changed in those 7 years, and he ends up coming to face some of the top Nazis at these Nuremberg trials. Mr. Sonnenfeld became a United States Army private, and he helped liberate the Dachau concentration camp. And what happened was that he was, when we'll get into some of his story here a little bit more in depth, but just to give you an overview, he ended up being a United States Army private. He wanted to go fight against the Nazis. And as it says, he helped liberate the Dachau concentration camp. And he was in an Army motor pool, and they found that he could speak fluent German, which was pretty rare. He could speak it very well, of course, because he grew up speaking it. And so he was taken to be chief interpreter. He was a rare native German speaker who had a firm command of English, so he could speak both languages very well. In that role, he participated in the pre-trial interrogations of prisoners, commonly held in the bare rooms of the Palace of Justice. And so he has a very fascinating story. He wrote a book called Witness to Nuremberg, and at the end of his book, he wrote this, a really interesting statement. He said, my youth under Hitler was meant to end in extermination. Instead, my life has been a terrific adventure. He had a terrific adventure, even though the situation that he found himself in there in Germany, which was becoming Nazi Germany as he was growing up, should have ended in his extermination. But those very terrible events that turned his life upside down also led him to an incredible adventure that he embraced. And he really did some amazing things. And so we have things happen to us too in life, right? Trials and tests. They can be very difficult, but sometimes they also open up the door for great adventure. And I thought Mr. Sonnenfeld's life was a great example of that. He was born Richard Wolfgang Sonnenfeld on July 23rd, 1923, in Berlin. And he grew up in Gardelegen in northeastern Germany. In 1938, his parents, Walter and Gertrude Sonnenfeld, they were both physicians, sent him and his younger brother Helmut to a boarding school in England as part of an attempt to move the family out of Germany. So he grew up with, you know, a pretty good circumstance early on, both his parents being physicians. But then, of course, things began to change. And he talks about when he was in school as a very young boy, they started up the Hitler Youth Program. Now, at the time, they didn't know how it was going to end up. They didn't know that it was going to be as bad as it was. And even he writes about the Jews in the community that he was in. They saw Hitler come in, but some of them said, well, you know, he's got some ideas that are okay. Of course, they didn't know everything he was going to do. And even the things that they didn't like about him, they said, well, give it time. He'll move out of office just like anybody, and the next person will come in. They didn't realize what was going to happen to them, and they were hoping, you know, that things would improve. But he makes the point that when he was a young boy in school, a lot of his friends joined the Hitler Youth Program. That was the exciting program. And he was disappointed he couldn't join it. He wanted to because he liked their uniforms and he liked the fact that they could march around and do those things. And so he didn't know what they were or what they were about. He was just a club after school that his friends could join and he couldn't join. So he was disappointed about that. And they were initially quite a well-to-do and popular family in their community, but then ultimately, of course, being Jewish, they became the pariah of the community. And so the parents had the means, thankfully, to send him and his brother out of Germany to England. And so if you think about this, they went to England, and it was so bad that if him and his brother weren't sent to England, they would have ended up in an extermination camp. And I don't know, you know, if they understood at the time how serious things were, but they had to get out of their own country. So you can put yourself in his shoes. You're 15 years of age. You have to leave your country, leave your parents. You know, you could really think this is a terrible situation. And it certainly was serious. But he looked at it like an adventure. Well, we're going to go to England. We're going to have an adventure in England. And so they went over there. His mother took him on the train ride to the ship to get out of Germany. And they had to have a Nazi guard inspect their papers to let the boys leave the country. So they didn't know for sure if they'd get out, but they were allowed to leave. And so Richard goes to England. He just speaks German at this time. So he's going to this boarding school in England. He's got to learn a completely different language. Now, if you've taken a foreign language in school, you know that can be a challenge. It can be hard to learn something different, especially English. English is a tough language to learn. But he loved it. He embraced it. He said, in fact, that he felt like the English language had been waiting just for him because he could express himself in ways that he couldn't with just the German language. At least that's what he felt. So he embraced it. He loved it. He loved his time in England, and he totally threw himself into this new adventure. And I think that's such a key point. He threw himself into it. Every adventure he went on, he just threw himself into it. Okay, I'm in England. I'm going to learn to speak English. I'm going to do everything that I can to embrace this adventure and make the most of it. And if he hadn't done that, he wouldn't have had the success that he did. He had no idea that a few years later he'd be used as a chief interpreter at the Nuremberg trials. If he had half-heartedly tried to learn English, he wouldn't have ended up in the position he did. He had no idea where it was going, but he threw himself into it. And because of that, he was able to master the English language. He wrote about how he would spend winter evenings at his teacher's nearby home close to the boarding school. They'd all walk over there. And he and his classmates would recite Shakespeare from memory. And not a little bit of Shakespeare, a lot of Shakespeare. They'd be beside this roaring fire. It was in the wintertime. And they'd be just spending their evening reciting Shakespeare from memory. You know, it's hard enough maybe to learn English, but he had to learn Shakespeare. I speak English. I don't know how well I could speak Shakespeare. But he really learned it. He learned it well. And it also just makes me think about how, you know, they didn't have all the distractions that we have today. They were spending their evenings reciting Shakespeare, and they loved it. They weren't spending their evenings, you know, absorbed in a device of some kind, a phone, the internet, playing some sort of video game, watching television. They were reciting Shakespeare. And it's amazing what our minds can do if we block out the distractions. They were reciting Shakespeare. And, of course, that was something that helped him in the future as he learned to master the English language. And at this time, keep in mind, now he's 15, 16 years old here. He spent a few years in England. He has no idea if his parents are alive. He doesn't know what happened to them. He hasn't seen them. They're back in Germany, which is, you know, having so much problems there and being very aggressive and at war. And so he doesn't know if his parents are even alive. And he could have really sat there and just sort of gone into a shell and worried about it. And I think I'm sure he thought about it a fair bit, but he really embraced this adventure he was on. He didn't spend all his time thinking about his parents. He was mastering the English language. He was memorizing Shakespeare. And he loved his experience there. He was embracing that adventure. 2 years later, in the midst of the war, Mr. Sonnenfeld was declared an enemy alien in England because of his nationality and deported to Australia. And so here he is, and at this time he was broken up from his brother because his brother, being only 14, was allowed to stay in England. So he had been in England for a while, and he loved it. He embraced it. He gave everything to it. And then it was pulled out from underneath him. So what did he do? Well, he just embraced the next adventure that came his way. Okay, we're off to somewhere else. And he was put on a ship that he thought was going to the United States. There was quite a few men on this ship. He was a young man at the time, of course, and there were older men on the ship. And he was held as a prisoner in the bottom of the ship. Remember, because he was a German, they considered him to be an enemy alien, even though he obviously wasn't involved in Germany's war efforts. But he was on this ship as a Jewish lad with actual Nazis. They were all in the bottom of this ship together. That doesn't sound like a fun time. I wouldn't want to do that. And they were held in the same part of the ship. But thankfully, they couldn't physically get to where the other prisoners were. So there was some separation physically, but they certainly let it be known they did not care for Richard, who was Jewish. And so he had this situation on this ship, and the Nazis were hurling insults at him. And so young Richard, he was a bit of a bold young man, courageous as well. And he had heard enough of the Nazi insults. And so he went over to them and he told the Nazi prisoners that he was going to tattoo the Star of David on them and send them back to Germany. So I don't know that that's a wise thing to say, but they certainly didn't like hearing that from him. And but it does show a little bit of his spirit of adventure, I guess, and his courage that he had enough of what they were saying. So many of the grown men on the ship really struggled. I mean, you can imagine you're being held in the bottom of the ship. You don't know where you're going. Your life is being turned upside down. And a lot of people struggled. These grown men on the bottom of the ship, a lot of them started crying. Some of them had nervous breakdowns. They clearly weren't heading to the U.S. The ship was going somewhere else, and people were panicking, and they didn't know what was happening. And so here's Richard. You know, he's this teenager, and he's on the bottom of this ship. Grown men are sobbing around him, having nervous breakdowns. There's Nazis down there hurling insults at him. I mean, you could really see where you could have some mental struggles. You could become very depressed. But he didn't do that. He didn't give in to the negativity. Richard began to think. He started to use his mind, and he thought about what he knew, and he knew something about geography. You know, he dedicated himself to his studies. So he did know something about geography, and he was able to figure out where the ship was going. He spent his time thinking about the geography, thinking about where they were, thinking about their movements, and trying to figure out where they were going instead of just sitting there and crying like the rest of them. And he figured out that the ship was going to Australia. They weren't going to the United States. They were actually going to Australia. When Richard got to Australia, he and the other prisoners were put on a several-day train ride to a prison camp in the center of Australia. And when he got there, there were no fences. And they were a little bit surprised. Where are the fences? You know, how are you going to hold this here? And the guards weren't worried about it. They just pointed at the water tower there and said, "That's the only water for 100 miles in any direction, so you're free to leave if you want to." And nobody left. They all stayed put. There was nowhere to go, and so they stayed there at that camp. And I thought that was sort of an interesting thing. You know, you don't need a fence to keep people in if there's no water anywhere. They'll stay where the water is. And so here he is now in an Australian prison camp. I mean, again, at every turn here, and we're just hitting these highlights, and so, but imagine living through that. You could be very negative. It'd be very easy to just hang your head and say, what is, you know, every time I think things are going good, I get the bottom taken out from under me. But it was just another adventure. He saw it all as an adventure, and he was positive. So after a few weeks in this prison camp, England sent word that Richard shouldn't be held as an enemy of the state. They had made a mistake. He was put back on the train, got back on the same ship, and this time he was sent to India. He's off to another adventure. In India, he spent a little over a year working in a shop repairing radios, and he was able to save up a good amount of money while in India and developed a lot of friendships, and he learned a lot about the culture. He spent his time learning and observing and growing. Being in India was a detour from where he hoped to go. He hoped to go to the United States, but he used his time to work, save money, make friends, have an adventure. He didn't sulk about it. He got to work. He got busy. You can see with a guy like this, no matter where he was, he made the best of it. He made the best of wherever you put him. And so he wasn't buffeted about by circumstances. He took advantage of every opportunity he had. He didn't feel sorry for himself. He just got to work. So eventually, after some time here, he was able to get passage to the U.S., which was hard to do. But he arrived in the U.S. on a ship traveling first class with a brand new suit. So he was really excited about that. After all these turmoil, he had enough money saved up. He went to the U.S. Not did he just go to the U.S., he went there traveling first class with a brand new suit. So that's a pretty good way to go from India to the United States. And there he was reunited with his parents. They had survived. Richard learned to be an expert electrical engineer. And he became a U.S. citizen. You know, not like some people today that want to take everything, it seems, and illegally enter the country. He wanted to come in, become a U.S. citizen, work at it, and then contribute. And he did. That's an attitude that's very commendable. And then he joined the U.S. military. He did not have to. But he joined the U.S. military to go back to Europe to fight the Nazis. He wanted to go back and fight. He wanted to fight for the United States. He wasn't, born in America, but he loved the ideals of America, the freedom that they were fighting for. Now, by the time he got to Germany, the war was ending, and he was basically rounding up surrendering German soldiers. And this is when the military realized that he spoke perfect German as well as English. And so he was able to be used quite effectively. He could get on the Germans' radio frequency and talk to them in German, and they didn't realize that they were actually talking to somebody from the U.S. military. So it was very effective. And the thing is, he didn't feel hatred towards the Nazis until he saw what they did to people in the extermination camps. He wanted to fight against them. He wanted to free Germany from their grip, but he didn't realize how bad it was until he got there and he saw what they had done to his people and to other people. And there was a certain hatred that he had at that point. Now, not every part of Richard's adventure was great. Some of it, some of the experiences were horrible and heartbreaking. But it was part of the adventure. And he learned from it. You know, every setback he learned from. He learned from all these opportunities that came his way. Richard then was used, as we talked about in the beginning, as the chief interpreter to interrogate the Nazis, all of the top men who were still alive, because he spoke the perfect German and English, and so he could be the interpreter. After his work in the trial, Richard was invited to dine and stay with the King of Sweden. So he had done so much good work that he ended up being able to dine with the King of Sweden after this adventure that he had been on. And it's amazing. It reminds me of Proverbs 22 and verse 29. Proverbs 22 and verse 29, where it says, "See you a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings." Did that happen to Richard? Sure it did. He was diligent in his business. He worked at this, whatever came his way. If he hadn't worked hard, none of it would have opened up for him. But he did. He worked hard. He embraced this adventure. And he actually did stand before kings. In fact, he ate dinner with the King of Sweden. I think he was able to even stay overnight there, if I remember the story correctly or the history. And so here we have a boy who should have died in the Holocaust. But he didn't. He went to England, Australia, India, the United States, back to Germany, and then found himself sitting with royalty. What an incredible adventure that he had. What an absolutely incredible adventure. But he embraced it. He embraced it. He could have very easily not embraced it and, felt negative about his situation and not put in work and not dedicated himself to learning all he could and just sort of giving up and hanging his head and feeling sad and sorry for himself. But he didn't. And he had tremendous results because of that. He had this spirit of adventure. There's somebody else that it made me think of that had a spirit of adventure as well. And we read about him in 2 Corinthians 11. You might remember some of this history. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 23, it says, "Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more." This is Paul, of course. "In labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequent, in deaths often. Of the Jews, 5 times received I 40 stripes save one. Thrice I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day I have been in the deep. In journeyings often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of mine own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and painfulness, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. Beside those things that are without, that which come upon me daily, the care of all the churches." And so the Apostle Paul had many adventures in the work of God, didn't he? Many adventures. And we all have different adventures. But we have to embrace those adventures. You know, Paul wasn't saying this because he was feeling sorry for himself. He was just letting the brethren know that he had put in a fair bit of work. And he went through quite a few trials, and he had been through a lot. But he did all of these things, you know, with the spirit of adventure. And he just kept after it. He didn't quit. He just kept working. It was just on to the next thing. It was on to the next thing. I mean, at any point in what even Paul's describing here, it'd be very easy for a person to give up. You know, 5 times he received 39 stripes. I don't know, after one time of receiving 39 stripes, I think people would, a lot of cases, say, well, that's enough for me. You know, he was beaten with rods 3 times, stoned, suffered shipwreck. You know, it'd be easy to stop and say, this is too much. I can't handle this. But he just kept going, and he kept working, and he kept learning and helping people and having just some incredible adventures. And it's easy to sort of read over these quickly because, again, it's a few words. But even just think about some of those things a little bit. You know, spending a night and a day in the ocean. I mean, that would, you'd think about that for the rest of your life. What a scary experience that would be, and that's just one of them. But these were adventures that he had, great adventures. And, of course, when there are adventures, there's usually some test and some trial and some difficulty that come along with it, and then a lot of excitement and a lot of joy as well. One last passage today. This relates to our time very specifically. Revelation 12. "Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you that dwell in them, and woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has but a short time." It says, "And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent." Verse 15 says, "And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood." In verse 16, "And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth." This sounds like quite an adventure. And of course, if you know much about this prophecy, it is talking about God's people having quite an adventure right before the return of Jesus Christ. And what you read about there is quite scary, in a sense. I mean, Satan being cast down, that's a terrifying thing. And again, it is. But at the same time, for God's people, when we commit our way to God and we strive to do his work and help it in every way we can, we have tremendous adventures, harrowing experiences, lots of excitement, very few dull moments. And there's always a lot to learn from it. And there's a lot of excitement to be had and to be part of. But we need to have a spirit of adventure. And we can see that, of course, with Paul's example. We can see that with Richard Sonnenfeld's example and other people over the years, historical figures, where really they went through some harrowing experiences, but they did it with a spirit of adventure and excitement and looking forward to some of the, you know, amazing things that were coming instead of hanging their heads and feeling sorry for themselves because of the situation that they found themselves in. So I think there's a lot to be learned from those situations, and some of that history is just another reason that reading history is very beneficial, because we see what other people went through and how they handled it, and we can learn a lot from them and hopefully emulate their positive examples. That's all the time we have for today on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Your regular host, Mr. Stephen Fleury, should be back here within a day or two, depending on his travels. He's on an adventure as well, and it's good to remember to be praying about the success of those personal appearance campaigns as they come up here over the next day or so. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for spending some time with me, and keep listening for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Monday through Friday at 7 a.m.